So before I get into this episode, I'd like to bring to light something I've been working on. If you're subscribed to my blog, you've probably heard of my Hunter Up initiative. If not, I'll try to sum it up for you. I'm afraid that hunting as we know it can go away, especially with the declining numbers of new hunters each year. I think it's so very important that we take the time and make a true effort to take the bull by the horns and each and every one of us personally introduce one new hunter into hunting. I'm also very unhappy with the hunting community as a whole, and its lack of respect for fellow hunters. We as a community spend a lot of time bashing each other over stupidity instead of promoting one another. The amount of energy that we spend arguing can be spent on more important things like conservation or introducing a kid into hunting. So I'm issuing all of you a challenge to take the time to help fellow hunters, introduce kids, and for God's sakes, stop promoting content that puts hunters in a bad light. Resist the urge to engage in these foolish arguments that we have. Stop the bashing. When you feel strongly about something or you disagree with a hunter, a fellow hunter, take that subject off social media, message that person directly, have a one-on-one debate about it. You're either going to leave understanding where that other person's coming from, or you're going to have said your piece and you move on. We're not all going to agree with the way others do things. And we don't have to. But what we should be doing is supporting all legal hunting because all we're doing is showing weakness and unrest within our community. And this just leaves chinks in the armor that let hunting, anti-hunting groups tear down what you have built, what we've all built. And we need to support hunting and hunters and use our efforts for good, like conservation and hunters education and introducing new hunters instead of wasting our time arguing about who predator hunts, who uses a Matthews and who uses a Hoyt. I mean, the stupid arguments that go on is just, it's okay to have debate, it's okay to have opinion, but really think about what it does when you argue on social media. You got to understand if there's something that's negative out there and you keep pushing it, I can't stress enough, if you don't understand the way Facebook algorithm works or Instagram or any of these, it's you comment on something, oh, you're an idiot for putting that out there. And you commenting on that just pushes that content up the ladder further and further until it gets wider and wider and the net gets larger and larger. And the more people can see it, the more people comment on it, the more people can see it. And eventually it's going to get in front of the eyes of somebody who's an anti-hunter and not just arguing about the hunt. And it's not good for us. So please stop the bashing and, get out there and help introduce hunters into hunting. Thanks again. And this episode, you can thank Phoenix Shooting Bags for bringing it to you. And this hunter initiative, they're helping me out with it. I appreciate what they're doing. And let's just jump into the next episode. Thank you.
Hi, welcome to the Interviews with the Hunting Masters brought to you by the Phoenix Shooting Bags. And today we're going to continue on with our DIY series of hunting elk and deer as an out-of-stater. And we are going to revisit Idaho. And I have my friend Corey Jacobson on from Elk 101. And we're going to talk about more about elk hunting in Idaho and just because Idaho has a lot of opportunity and there's a lot to know about that state. And I think it's if somebody's wanting to do a do it yourself hunt and try something, or try something out west, or try something out of state, period. It's one of those states that offers you a really good opportunity to do so. So that's why we're going to kind of hit it again. How are you doing this morning?
I'm doing great. Thanks, John.
Yeah. So, did you put in for New Mexico?
I did not.
Oh, okay.
No, I know several people. My phone lit up yesterday with a lot of friends that ended up drawing, so it sounds like it was a good year to put in, but I've
Yeah.
got a pretty full plate in September, so I bypassed putting in for New Mexico.
Yeah, I only put in for Ibex over there now, because I put in for like 10 years straight for elk, and I don't draw. So I'm like, you know what? I'm not getting rewarded with a bonus point, and whatever I'm doing is not right. I'm not picking the right units. Actually, my buddy called me yesterday, and his 16-year-old daughter drew a really good rut rifle bull tag, and so
Very cool.
I may or may not go with them, depending on what, because it's that first week of October, and right now October is my only open month, which is actually, I'm planning on, me and Chad Roberts are planning on going to Idaho to hunt elk and probably deer in
Very cool.
October. That was kind of the plan. If I'm like, if I don't draw Ibex, which would be that first 2 weeks of October, or the chances of me drawing a mountain goat, or a better chance of winning the lottery. But that was my two things that I saved for October, and if I don't get those, then Idaho is where I'm planning on doing.
Yeah,
So.
and that's really the beauty of Idaho is with so much over-the-counter opportunity, you can kind of go through the draw season and then fill in with the OTC as needed.
Yeah. Now, is it a tr it's not a true OTC. It's like a first come, first serve type tag.
Some units do have a limited quota that's first come, first serve, and there's a handful of popular ones that do sell out pretty quickly.
Okay.
But for the most part, there's several units that you can just show up and buy a tag, and it is true OTC.
Okay. So you could actually, you don't actually have to put in, you don't have to apply to get the tag. You can actually go to a fishing game and just buy a tag and go.
Can stop at Walmart on your way to hunting camp and pick up a tag in most units.
Is that for deer as well? Oh, Jesus.
Yep, in fact, I can look here real quick and see. Yeah, it says in the regulations which units and which zones, like for elk, for instance, are capped with a non-resident limit that would be first come, first serve. And there's not a lot. I'm looking through here and seeing 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. It's like nine zones out of the whole state are capped for non-residents, for residents
Okay.
and non-residents. So there's a capped number of tags. And like you mentioned, they do go on sale first come, first serve. I believe they go on sale for non-residents. I think it's the 1st of December.
Oh, wow.
If there's still tags available right now in those capped units, they probably won't sell out.
10-4. Okay. Cool. Now, everything's getting so jumbled in my head. I mean, learning all these states. I'm trying to remember now. It's when you get a tag for Idaho, you're getting it for a specific zone. It's not like here when you buy an archery deer tag, it's for the whole state.
Right.
You got to
So
you.
for deer, the state is broken up into a regular deer tag or a whitetail deer tag, and they have different areas and different seasons within those areas. So if you buy, for instance, a whitetail deer tag, you may still be able to shoot a mule deer with it, but the season is going to be shorter in the areas where there's going to be mule deer. And on, vice versa, if you buy a regular deer tag, that's primarily your mule deer tag in the southern part of the state, but you can still hunt whitetail up to a certain point with that regular deer tag in the northern part of the state in most of the units. And for the most part, outside of like the really good mule deer hunts, Most of the state is over the counter for whitetail and mule deer.
Okay. And on the elk too, it's unit specific or is it a statewide tag?
No, it's unit specific, so it's actually zone specific. So
A
some
zone
of the
specific.
zones have three or four of the actual units in that zone. And
Okay.
if you buy a tag for a specific zone, you have to hunt the units that are included in that zone.
Okay, 10-4.
And then within the elk tag also, there's an A tag or a B tag. And the A tag is primarily your archery tag, and the B tag is primarily your rifle tag. And again, there's some crossover there. So if you buy an A tag, for instance, in a particular zone, you may have an opportunity to rifle hunt for a spike in October, or you may have an opportunity to muzzleload hunt in November with that A tag. And again, each zone is really completely different. They manage each zone very specifically. And again, with the rifle tags, so with a B tag, that's your primary. You get to hunt the full rifle season, usually like October 15th or October 10th through the end of October, first part of November. But with the B tag, you can also archery hunt the first 2 weeks of the archery season in some zones, or you may be able to have a late archery hunt or a late muzzleloader hunt as well with that. So it really depends. You need to focus in on what zone you want to hunt and then see what seasons are available with the tags in that zone.
Okay. Yeah, it makes sense. So, but are there any limited entry hunts for the elk
There
then?
are.
Okay.
Yep. And Idaho's managed for opportunity. And like we discussed a bit ago, you can go through and you can apply for units like Nevada, Arizona, Wyoming, all these, draw only states for non-residents. And if you don't draw your tags, you can always fall back on an OTC state, which, I think really the only true over-the-counter option states that are even worth considering for elk are Idaho and Colorado. You also have Oregon that has true OTC, but you do have to buy your tag before the season starts there. And then Montana, just depending on how the draw goes in Montana, a lot of times there are leftover elk licenses in Montana that you can buy over the counter that are basically OTC.
I'm actually planning on doing Oregon this year. That is my elk my that is my September plan. I have a client here in Arizona. So I'm going to go the early part of the season, early September, like maybe September 1st, that first week or two. I'm gonna go to Oregon. I'm gonna be hunting with Shannon Mobbs. I took him out coos deer hunting and he's gonna take me hopefully to get a Roosevelt. So
Very cool.
yeah, that's one I gotta notch off the bucket list. And then yeah, and then like I said, I come back and then I have a client here who's actually a friend of mine who drew a 7 East tag, which is not the greatest tag in the whole world when it comes to Arizona, but it's a good tag and it can produce really, really good bulls. I've seen personally on that hunt, I've seen bulls over 400, which are, that's giant bull anywhere, not just Arizona. Who's to say? I don't know. I don't really like the where for Arizona hunting, and I know it's not as big a deal, and we'll probably get into this because I was going to ask you this question. It's not as big a deal in other states, but in Arizona, because of our weather and it being really hot, I don't like that the full moon is hitting right when the middle of the season is here, like right
I
where the
actually,
peak of the rut should be, and
yeah.
because that shuts them down a bunch. Not shuts them down, just gets them up all night so they're not really up on their feet as much during daylight hours. But
I couldn't agree more. And that was my first experience with the effect of the full moon was when I hunted Arizona, and I just bought points this year in Arizona because of that very reason. We're up where we probably could draw, and just looking at the moon phase, I think the full moon hits on the 23rd, and the season dates are great in Arizona this year, and as far as rut effect, but with the full moon right in the middle, I opted for the points. And I noticed the same thing. I've hunted Arizona 3 times, twice for myself and once with a friend. And full moon has an effect there. In Idaho, Wyoming, Montana, places like that, I don't worry hardly at all about the full moon
No,
just
because it's
because
not.
the elk, Yeah, I mean the elk are just more responsive during the day, and so I can still go in the middle of the day and get elk to respond. But man, in Arizona it was like 8:30 in the morning. It was a switch, it shut off, and I couldn't buy
Shuts
a
down.
bugle the rest of the day.
Yeah, and a lot of it has to do with, I think, what unit you're hunting, like, and the elevation that you're hunting at, because this happens to be 7 East, happens to be one of the highest elevations you can get in Arizona, really. I mean, it's San Francisco Peaks. You could go all the way up to 13,000 or 12,000 or whatever it is, if you wanted to. So if you get in some of those areas where it's up, you can get really cool weather, getting up higher in elevation, getting colder weather. It's not as bad, but you hunt some of these, like, especially the ones that are like juniper, pinyon juniper areas where you're 5, 6,000 feet. Yeah, it shuts down quick because it's hot. It's 90 to 95 degrees outside, So they don't, if they could be up all night partying with the spotlight, they'll do it. People think I'm crazy with that. I'm glad you kind of said it, kind of validates my experiences. I mean, I've talked with other guys, some really good outfitters here too that have that same mentality. But yeah, moon to me. I'm always constantly, when I plan my whole season, I'm always looking at the moon. Like, oh, if I'm going to take this date and this season date, and I'm kind of like, and I adjust it, to the region and so on and so forth. But I look a lot at it. There's sometimes you can't avoid it. I mean, if you want to go hunting, you got to do it. You got to do it. But
Totally. And I've noticed, like Utah, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico, the full moon truly has an effect on the elk. I don't know if it's demographics of the herd that, I don't know what it is, but they're different than northern states like
yeah.
Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, even Colorado. We can get elk to bugle. Sure, they're going to bed a little earlier. They're up all night feeding and rutting, and they go to bed a little earlier in the morning, but I prefer to hunt them during the middle of the day anyway sometimes. And in those states, it doesn't really affect the midday hunting. In fact, sometimes it makes it better because the elk do go to bed so early that midday they're getting restless and they actually get up and are more active midday. But yeah, Arizona, that the times I've been there, both times there's been full moon, and it's just a light switch goes off and the woods go silent, and it can be tough to buy a bugle.
Yeah. And the one thing I did notice, and you kind of alluded to something like that about that, is that the midday activity, you'll see some more, like the cows will get up and feed again. And you won't really hear bugling as much, but you'll see action at water holes, at wallows, and stuff like that, where an elk will go, a bull will go in and maybe go in there to cool down or whatever. But a lot of times you'll see the cows will get up and feed again. They'll want to go to water in midday, and then, of course, the bull's going to follow them. But yeah, other than that, but like, I feel like from a strictly chase and bugle standpoint, it's much harder.
Definitely.
So going back to Idaho, there's a pretty vast change in terrain from what elk occupy. And I know it's kind of hard to simplify it, but if you can break it down into, a couple different regions of habitat type, and then kind of then we'll talk about where elk are located within those habitat types. That would be
For sure.
really helpful.
Yeah, so if you basically take the freeway from Ontario, Oregon, and go straight east to just east of Burley, and then head south into Utah there, that lower southwest corner is pretty much all desert. And there's a little exception down out at Twin Falls, which has some actual really good elk hunting. But for the most part, those are complete desert. The Owyhee Mountains and some of the South Mountains out of Twin Falls really taper down into desert country. And then north of the freeway up to about you could probably go up to the Salmon River, that parallel across there. That section of the state is going to have a lot more open country, open south-facing ridges with timber on the north sides, good glassing opportunities. A lot of elk still cover in that country, but you don't get into quite as much of the heavy timber. And then you go north of the salmon, and the farther north you go up into the panhandle, it gets thicker and brushier pretty much every mile you go until it's just a rainforest up there. But yeah, so it's, yeah, you've got a ton of different variation in terrain, even within some of the units. Some of the units have the desert, you know, flat open grassland up into some sagebrush foothills all the way up to, you know, 10,000-11,000 feet with, you know, you've got heavy timber in between and then you're above timberline all in the same unit. You can get into that different habitat.
Right. Okay.
Because and honestly, elk range from the bottom of the state to the top. They literally inhabit every habitat and terrain that we have in Idaho.
So in the deserty type stuff, I'm assuming that's like a high desert. I mean, I've been to Idaho several times. I just don't remember what the, I don't think I've ever been in any of the desert stuff because I've always flown into Boise and then we drove north a couple times that I've been there. Was it what is like a sage, like sage bowls or is it?
Yeah,
like...
you pretty much have, you know, the sage flats, and then you'll have the rocky canyon lands where they'll go and bed down, and a lot of it, you know, you get the juniper and pinyon type stuff on the foothills in that area.
Okay.
But yeah, a lot of those elk will, they'll hang right out, you know, in the rock canyons and in the rim rocks there, and come up in the evenings to feed.
Okay, and then so on kind of that middle ground stuff, the open hillsides, it's, you know, is that typical elk, you know, bedding on thick north stuff and then feeding on the south? Or...
Yep. And that's, you know, that's what makes it so appealing for especially a rifle hunter, you know, an over-the-counter unit that you can get on a ridge and glass multiple open ridges from there. Mm-hmm. Where the elk are going to come out and feed first thing in the morning and again at dark, you can glass that, and then they usually just drop over the backside of the ridge onto those thicker, cooler north-facing slopes and bed there. So, you know, you either can get in and get a stalk and get a shot if you're rifle hunting, or if you're archery hunting, you see them first thing in the morning, they drop into the timber, and you can actually get in there and hunt them and call them in. So it's a really good mix of being able to see elk and have cover to be able to hunt them.
Yeah. Me personally, I think that's what I'm leaning towards. You know, I've talked with Chad. I think he's wanting more to get a nice mule deer, and the elk is secondary. And I think I'm the other way around. So it's gonna be interesting to see if we can't find something that satisfies both. And given that it's gonna be, you know, October or whatever, and possibly late October, you know, I'm going to want to rely on my glass because, you know, I don't think that bugling or anything like that is going to be very effective.
And that's the beauty of Idaho. You know, mule deer are the same. They go all the way from the desert flats and the rocky rim rocks to the high country above timberline. And so that country that we're talking about, that middle where you have the open and the timber, it's probably some of the best mule deer country as well. You know, there's some draw units in the Owyhees and the Bennett Mountains and things like that that are more of your sagebrush rocky with a little bit of timber up at the top. And those are the most well-known mule deer draw units. Mm-hmm. But outside of those, to get into the big mule deer bucks, it's usually going to be in those same units where you're going to have that open country to glass with timber on the backside and finding bucks at timberline or as they come down with weather.
Cool. Yeah. And that's what I was hoping and figuring, you know, just from being in other parts of the country, seeing very similar type, you know, coexisting the same type of habitat.
Yeah.
So when you're looking at, that's probably going to be a hard question for you to answer because you've been hunting Idaho your whole life and, you know, you go where you go because whatever way or whatever reason or another, you figured it out, you know, at one point, or your dad or, you know, whatever. But what's your, I mean, if you're looking at the state as a whole, how would you approach trying to choose choose the area, you know, obviously not
For
knowing
sure. Just
what
coming
you do.
blind, how do you pick a
Yeah.
spot type of thing. Yeah. So, you know, and I honestly, it's the same for any state. And in Idaho, I'm continually looking for new areas. I mean, we don't just, yeah, we have our primary areas that we like to hunt, but I'm always looking for something better.
Right.
And basically what I start out with, you know, setting my goal for the hunt. What is it I want to accomplish? Am I looking for big trophy bulls? Am I looking for tons of bugling action in September? Am I, you know, looking for a rifle hunt in November when the bulls are bachelored up? So I think that's the most important thing, is to identify what the goal for the hunt is. And then from that, you can narrow down to an area or a group of units. And from there, I go to the Fish and Game website. And Idaho's actually, having looked at all 10 Western elk states and their websites and regulations, Idaho's actually got a pretty decent website and regulations that are fairly easy to follow. And on the website, you can get in and look at just about any statistic you want. They have a map that shows management population objectives, so you can see where the elk are over objective, meeting objective, or under objective, and kind of see, you know, what the population of elk in the area is going to be like based on how they're trying to manage it. You can look at, if it's a controlled hunt, obviously all the statistics for draw odds are on the website. What I look at more though are percentage of 6-point bulls taken. So you can look at that, and if a unit has, you know, 35% success rate and 40% of the bulls taken are 6-point or better, you know that there's a good age class of animals in there. So that's helpful and important. You can see the number of hunters that are in that unit by unit, not just within the zone, but each unit within the zone. You can see how many hunters hunted in there, how many days they hunted, success rates for all that. So taking all of those statistics and having a goal when you start out, you can really hone in on just a couple units pretty quickly.
Okay. Yeah. I haven't messed around on their website a whole bunch, other than to go in and, you know, apply.
Yeah.
And I think I didn't know they had all that statistics on there. I think I was relying on like GoHunt or whatever more so than anything.
Yeah, and they have a hunt planner on Idaho's website that's similar to, you know, GoHunt, where it's not as detailed, but you can put in some of those criteria and see what comes up as available units.
Okay,
And then
cool. Yeah,
from
no,
there,
I'll
you know,
check that
if you
out.
can narrow it down to one or two units, from there it's a lot more simple to jump in on Google Earth or something and start picking apart the actual unit.
Right. Cool. So once you've you know, you've gone through this and you've kind of narrowed down some sections and so on and so forth, again, we're you know, what's your next step? You know, what's your next starting point? Where do you or you know, where do you
Yeah.
go from there, so to speak?
So once you get the unit you're going to hunt, you know, as I mentioned, I jump onto Google Earth, and Google Earth is the first place I go if I know general area where I'm hunting, and just start getting a feel for the area. Honestly, if you know what you're looking for on Google Earth, elk areas pop right out, and you can see these are probably the four areas within a unit that are going to be the best areas for elk. And typically, I've been pretty fortunate, but typically looking at those specific things on Google Earth, I'm usually able to get right into elk out of the gate. And you know, I just look for sources of food, sources of water, and then bedding areas. And if you can find all those in close proximity, you can usually count on elk being there.
I know, and I know this is kind of hard because we're doing this verbally. And actually, the app that we're using, there's a feature for you to share your screen, and you can actually pull up Google Earth and show us. But I didn't prep you for that, so we're not going to get into that. I don't want to fumble. But how do you, looking at Google Earth, and I'm doing this for listeners that probably
Yeah.
asking the same question that I did, you know, years ago when somebody gave me an answer like you just did. How do I know what bedding cover is? How do I know what
Totally.
feeding is by looking at a map, you know, or
Yeah.
aerial photo?
No, and that's, I mean, one of the most common questions I would get from hunters. You know, they're looking at it. I'm saying, okay, you're going out of state, jump on Google Earth and find some spots. And you know, I'd get emails all the time with pins from Google Earth saying, hey, how does this look? And So ultimately, when I created the University of Elk Hunting online course, there's a full module in there on scouting and a full chapter just on Google Earth, where I jump in and walk people through, kind of like you're saying, with a screen share
Nice.
on the screen, showing what we're looking for. But verbally and in a nutshell, the first thing I look for is north-facing slopes. Those are the bedding areas. So if I can find, I basically just orient Google Earth, so I'm looking into it from the north, and you can see all the north-facing slopes. And those north-facing slopes, that really becomes about a quarter of the unit right there. So you narrow it down just that, and then you find good dark timber where there's north-facing slopes. And then I like to look for big open ridges adjacent to those north-facing slopes. So something open, elk like to browse. An open hillside is going to provide grass for that. A clear cut's going to have browse in it. So I look for open areas, which are really easy to identify on Google Earth. So you've got two of the three right there, and really you're narrowed down to 5 or 10% of the unit already just from those two. And then I just zoom in from there and look for water. And it took me a while to figure it out on Google Earth, but Google Earth, actually, you can go in and select different map dates. And so they have different dates, date ranges. So I can go in and actually find a map from, September. It might be from 2013 or something, but I can look at an actual September image of that area. And when I do that, I'm just looking for green areas, the lush green meadows, streams, any kind of a water source that's going to tell me the elk can go there and have water. Because there's a lot of places in Idaho that you get up in, 8,000 to 12,000 feet, and you won't find a water source, period. And knowing that, there
Crazy.
still might be elk there, but they're going to travel 4 or 5 miles to water and spend time bedding on the north faces close to that. So finding water is critical. If I can find bedding, food, and water all in close proximity to each other, I've narrowed it down to probably 4 or 5 spots within that unit that really stand out to me. And then I look and make sure they're all at least, I can get at least 1 mile off of a road in those units or those areas within the unit. And
Right.
I'm in business and I have a place to go hunt.
I'm going to take what you said a little bit further. I think, and you tell me if you think this is good info or not. I've kind of, and I adapted this. I kind of learned it from whitetail hunting, believe it or not. That when I locate those bigger items that you were discussing, like bedding, food, water, I look within that. So like on the north facing slope, I'll change my map to a topography map and I look for benches. And then those adjacent hillsides that have the open, feeding areas and whatnot, I look for saddles leading from the bedding cover to those. And I try to look at landscape features, and kind of discern like travel corridors. I kind of start picturing trails and whatnot. And I mean, obviously a lot of that comes with experience and putting boots on the ground and knowing where those things, occur. Believe it or not,
Totally.
if you, I have a book that I authored, I don't know, Jesus, over 10 years ago now. Called The Whitetail Hunter's Blueprint, and there's a whole section there, and I wrote an article called "Mapping Trophy Bucks" that you can find on the internet pretty easy. If you read that article, it kind of give you some insight. Elk use terrain the same way. I mean, all animals use terrain the same way. They're
Totally.
always looking for the path of least resistance. They're, just like you, uncomfortable on a 90, on a 45-degree angle. They want to, they want their bodies to be somewhat level too. So and they find that comfort a lot easier than we do, but so it might just be a little strip of straight ground. But yeah, so it's looking for the things that Corey said and then looking within those things. I think that really helps pinpoint areas to start.
Definitely. And then
Because
from there, and some people, especially talking about, a non-resident hunter coming to a state, you don't always have the luxury of putting boots on the ground and scouting. If you can, I don't necessarily go into an area looking for elk per se, I think it's more just to get a feel for the country and understand, okay, Google Earth lied and it's really a lot steeper than it looks. Or, that basin that I was planning on hiking through and a morning hunt's going to take 2 days to get through. Just things like that that are helpful. And then, of course, I do go in there and if I can, actually do some scouting, see what kind of signs in there. Again, in a place like Idaho, hunting an over-the-counter tag, your goal is not to shoot a giant, a trophy. I mean, yes, that's there. It's possible, and we definitely, we pinpoint and kind of look for the higher age class animals. But with that being said, I don't set out trail cameras and necessarily try to find a specific bull that I want to hunt. And in a mountain state like Idaho, those bulls sometimes will travel 18 or 20 miles, from where they are in the summer to where they go to rut. They don't necessarily just go a mile and find the cows all the time. And so you might find a bull in July and come the 5th of September, he's gone and you don't even know what unit he's in anymore. So if I am looking for elk, I'm looking for cows because if I'm hunting the rut, the bulls are looking for cows in September too. And if you can find the cows, the bulls are going to end up there. And rather than find a bull in July and then try to track him down and see where he goes to stage in August and then see where he goes to find the cows in September, just go find the cows and sit and wait for him to show up. And, again, not pinpoint a specific bull, but getting into bulls. If I can find a group of 80 or 100 cows, there's going to be a handful of herd bulls there in September. So if I am scouting, I'm looking for cows and I'm looking for signs of indications that there's been rut activity there in the past. So if there's a bunch of rubs, if there's wallows, things like that, then that tells me the elk have rutted here in the past and they're probably going to rut in the same area again this season.
No, I have that same mentality. I never, and I found that out by accident. Not really by accident, as so much as by trial and error, that I would find all these awesome bulls here in Arizona and have them on my trail camera when they were in velvet, and then the rut came and I can never find them again.
Or if they showed up on somebody else's trail camera in a
Who
unit
knows?
20 miles away.
Exactly. So, and I stopped and I started treating them like I already had did. Again, I'm going to go back to freaking whitetail, which is I and maybe it's because that was my first big game animal that I got into when I was a kid, that I kind of look I relate everything back to that. But in the rut, when if I knew I was going to hunt the rut, I always hunted the does. I'm like, well, why wouldn't that work for elk? Or my that's I'll go find where all the cows are at, and then they're not going to leave their patterns unless some crazy weather event happens. And then just go back in there, and sure enough, I started doing that, and then we started seeing elk, we started seeing bulls, and so no, that's really good sound advice, and you a lot of people would take that for granted and think that's it seems too easy, but it really is. It's just
Yeah,
that.
it maybe not easy, but simple. I mean, it really is. Elk are simple-minded. They need three basic needs. You find those needs, you find the elk. And during September, the bulls have one additional need of breeding. And if you're looking for food, water, and bedding for the cows, and cows are what the bulls need, it's really simple.
Absolutely. Now, so let's fast forward to post rut. And I don't, in October, I mean, here in October, we're still seeing quite a bit of rutting activity. Matter of fact, I've seen it all the way up to the end of November. I've had that late archery tag here a couple times and had bulls bugling. But what if anything, how does your tactics change, when that rifle season kicks in and you're, they're not really screaming anymore. What are you
Yeah.
doing to, what are you doing
Yeah,
there?
I think it comes down again to understanding, the elk behavior and the elk needs. During that time of year, the bulls no longer are breeding really. Like you said, there might be some activity, a little flurry of rut activity here and there for a cow that didn't get bred the first time, or depending on the demographics there. But for the most part, by October 15th, when most of the rifle seasons, post-rut seasons in Idaho open, the rut's pretty much wound down. And if you're there the first couple of days of the season, you might be able to get an elk to bugle. You might even be able to call one in, but I don't count on that. I definitely take my bugle with me, but I don't count on it. So what I'm looking for are those bulls, once the rut's over, especially the bigger herd bulls, they're going off by themselves. They're not with the herd anymore. They're finding, literally, you'll find these herd tracks, and then overnight you'll start seeing single tracks where the bulls just go, and they're going to rest and recover. And, they're just finding a little sanctuary somewhere where it's thick, where they aren't going to get bumped, where they can just lay right there and recover, and they're going to have food and water close by. So you aren't seeing the big bulls out and about roaming like you do in the rut. So finding a vantage point where you can see the edges of multiple sanctuaries, where you can watch an open ridge or a clear cut where a bull's going to step out right at daylight or right at last light and feed for 10 or 15 minutes, then go back into his little patch there. And a lot of times you can watch him bed down and then get in and hunt, but it's way more optics at that point. I'm focusing all of my efforts for finding the elk on that first, probably realistically 30 to 45 minutes of daylight, and then the last 30 minutes of light in the evening, and then making a strategy from there on how to hunt it. So still covering a lot of country, but really focusing on optics to find those single bulls that have moved off. And sometimes you'll find them, a couple bulls together, but very rarely are you seeing those big herd bulls with the cows still, especially as you get into later October.
Cool. So do you think it's, let's say October 15th it opens, I don't really know the date, but for that rifle, do you think it's better to come that first week or kind of wait until, later on?
Yeah. And it's, again, you go from that post rut, October 10th or so through the first part of November. And then after that, you get into kind of a later season where weather becomes a factor. And then you do see those bulls that have kind of, in the post rut, went by themselves into their sanctuaries. You see them, solo, not moving, very low visibility. And then as the weather starts pushing them down, that's when you start seeing them come back into their bachelor groups. You'll start seeing three, four, five bulls together, and food is a priority then. So in October, I think security is their highest priority. There's a lot of pressure in an over-the-counter unit. There's a lot of other hunters out there. Those elk know how to survive, and they do that by just hunkering down and not moving. And so if you can find some of those areas where they go year after year to get away from the hunting pressure, they're going to be there every year. And, really a successful, consistently successful rifle hunter knows those areas and can just get in there every year and knows where the bulls are coming out to feed and can be successful. As you get into November and the weather starts hitting, then that can be a factor. And in Idaho, sometimes the weather hits the middle of October, sometimes it doesn't hit until December. So counting on that can be a little bit difficult. But if you do get a lot of weather mid to late October, that the end of the season, that runs usually till November 3rd or so, can be really good because the bulls are more visible, it's cold, they're out feeding longer, and you can get eyes on them a little easier. With that being said, if you hunt October 15th, opening day, a lot of times that pressure hasn't hit yet, and if you can get back in several miles, those bulls don't know that it's rifle season quite yet. They haven't been shot at, and they haven't ran to their sanctuaries, and a lot of times you still can get some good bugling action, or at least locate them with the bugle and be able to get in closer and see them on an open hillside as they're going to bed or something.
Cool. I got a lot to think about for my own hunt. It's so tough. So I don't ever get to go scout anything. Hell, I don't even get to go scouting here in my own state. The only time I actually go and do scouting is if I know I got a client coming that I have to take out because, they're paying for it. So, but for my own personal hunts, I just don't have the time anymore. And I go on enough destination hunts that I would have to give up that to do that. It's like it'd be a trade-off. So it's do I get to go hunting more often, or do I want a better quality of animal and try to? So, I came to terms with it a long time ago that I'm more happy just being out there hunting and not really worried about what caliber of animal I'm putting on the ground. I mean, don't get me wrong, I want to shoot something big, but I'm equally happy just shooting something that's mature. I don't know if I'd say that. That'd be a lie. Equally happy is not it.
Well, that's your goal. Your goal is to go and have opportunity.
Yes, exactly. So,
but, yeah, and I think there is a difference there because a lot of hunters do focus on the trophy and they hunt by themselves. They don't have hunting partners that they have to share the time with, the week with. They have every day to hunt for themselves. They take the whole month and focus on finding that one big animal, and that's their goal and their style. And then there's others who are, you know, probably like you and I that want to hunt two or three states in the month of September and don't have time to scout, don't have the resources to be able to go and scout anyway. So we just do as much homework as we can online and, you know, realize that we have to have opportunity or encounters to create opportunities and opportunities to create success. And we have to find elk. We have to, or whatever animal we're hunting, we have to know how to find them and not waste the entire week trying just to find them before we even start hunting them.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I live my seasons 5, 6, 7, sometimes days at a time, and that's it. I mean, that's my hunting season. Cause it's not like you get to go scouting or you know, you can't, that's just not often you get to go back. The only time I ever have the luxury of that is really is our over-the-counter deer tag here, where I have more time to, you know, be picky and choosy and pass things up. And so real quick, because I was going to ask you this, but something just popped up in my head. Are you allowed to use radios in two-way radios in Idaho?
So let me check really quick, because you used to be able to. It used to be completely okay. There was something here not too long ago that they proposed doing away with them. So I can check real quick here because regulations are pretty concise and easy to use. Electronic calls. It is unlawful. 9596. Let me just jump here in the regulations and give you an answer on that because.
Yeah, I was thinking about that. I was like, on a spot and stalk hunt, if I'm going with a partner, I'd like to have radio if I can.
Yep.
And I know, you know, there's several states out there that you're not allowed to use them. And I mean, that's a whole debate that I don't really get. I mean, people talk about, oh, fair chase and da 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 da. Like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't see it. I mean, I don't see it being any more less fair chase than some of the other tools that are allowed, but.
Yeah, no, it doesn't look like there's anything in the regulations that's changed. It just says it's illegal to use aircraft, including unmanned aircraft, to locate game and communicate location to persons on the ground, or to use any helicopter to transport hunters, gear, or game, except at established landing fields. It's illegal to use any aircraft, including unmanned, to locate any big game animals for the purpose of hunting during the same calendar day those animals were located. And then the other part of electronics is it's illegal to take big game with the aid of radio telemetry using
there goes that.
Radio collars, things like that. But yeah, so as of right now, it looks like still completely okay to use radios to communicate. It seemed like, you know, when they were talking about it, what they were wanting to get away from was using radios to guide each other into an animal. You could use them to communicate, safety, things like that, but you couldn't use them to sit on a hillside and say the elk's 100 yards below you or things like that. And I don't even see that in there, so that must not have gone through either.
Cool. Good deal. So the question I was going to ask before that little tidbit popped in my head was there anything specific about Idaho elk, like behavior or something that they do that is different from some of the other states that you have hunted?
Like, you know, I'm a huge proponent, if I'm able to hunt all day long. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, the elk bed down, they aren't as vocal, they aren't active, and that's true. But in a state like Idaho, I would say that nearly half of the elk that I've actually killed have been between the hours of 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock. And we call it midday
Nice.
madness. You know, noon is the magic hour. And if we'll stay out all day and keep hiking with the goal of locating an elk with a bugle. And if I can get an elk to bugle during that midday time frame, the chances of calling that bull in go way up. And so I think for Idaho, it probably of all the states, and I've hunted 8 of the 10 western elk states for elk, Idaho of all the states is probably the one that is most favorable to hunt midday. The elk just seem to respond better. I think the north faces, they've got cool north faces where they aren't affected by heat as much. But for whatever reason, hunting midday for elk, especially during the rut with a bugle, can be really effective, probably more so in Idaho than in other states.
Nice. Nice. I'm gonna have to keep that in mind for sure. You made me think of what two states haven't you hunted?
I have not drawn a tag in Nevada yet, and I have
Surprised.
not hunted Washington yet.
Oh, I'm
Um, and
surprised.
Was
Wow, Washington, actually, because it's
well,
so close.
it is close. So Washington, the over-the-counter stuff in Washington, there's not a lot of it. And aside from Roosevelt's, which will probably be what I end up hunting in Washington, just to experience Washington, there's some good over-the-counter Roosevelt hunting. But the Rocky Mountain hunting in Washington is pretty much all draw. And I put in for just about every state that I can. But Washington, you actually have to buy the license and tag in order to apply for a quality hunt. And if you don't draw the quality hunt, you're stuck with a spike tag, hunting a spike over the counter or in that unit. And it's expensive. I don't remember what it is, $600, $700 or whatever. That's a big investment for a spike tag that you're stuck with. And I just haven't, I don't even mess with Washington. And once I get Nevada out of the way, just to complete the 10 states, I'll probably go and hunt Roosevelt's there.
Cool.
Yeah.
Nevada is a tough one to draw, for
It
sure. I mean,
is.
for there's some units that you could draw pretty frequently, I think, but it's definitely a state that I want to go to. I have a couple of good friends that guide there, and I'm sure if I do draw, I'll be in good hands with
Yep.
some knowledge.
And I
But
was late to the game in Nevada. I only
so was
have, I
I.
think I'm at 5 points. So, you know, it's something that you can draw. They just square your points. It's a bonus point. So anybody can draw every year. There's just so few non-resident archery or non-resident antlered bull tags in Nevada that, you know, the chances of drawing are pretty low. Even when you get up to 10 points, you know, it's still not a slam dunk draw.
No, that's for sure. I think I'm about the same as you, 4 or 5 points, maybe six, but I don't have a whole lot. Yeah, I basically have burned through all the states that I had any real good a good bank of points. I've drawn them out. I'm drawn out now. Like, so I'm
And that's what
back
I
down.
try to rotate my points so that I've got my high quality areas that I'm building points for, and then some, you know, lesser areas that take points, and then OTC. And so I burned 10 points in Oregon, I burned 10 points in Utah. I drew New Mexico first time in a 4% drawed unit, first choice, and got
Nice.
lucky there. But now I'm up, I've got 14 or 15 elk and deer points in Colorado. I'm back up to
Oh,
10 or
wow.
11 elk points in Arizona. And then Nevada's coming up. I'm rebuilding in Oregon. So trying to stagger it so I have, you know, every 3 or 4 years I can look forward to a pretty good tag.
Nice. No, you're sitting pretty good, man. Way better than me. Yeah, my
Yeah, a couple.
last good chance was Utah, and I drew last year. That's not true. I still have Wyoming. I have like 9 points in Wyoming, so hopefully, I think according to GoHunt anyway, I have a very, very good chance of drawing the unit that I want to draw next year.
Very cool. Yeah, you know, Colorado, I've got, I think, 15 deer and elk points, which sounds
Dang,
really
dude.
exciting, but for elk, it's It's really
Yeah,
not
for
worth
elk it's
anything.
not, but for deer, man, you can draw, a fourth season hunt.
Yeah. Which, honestly, I would love to draw an archery hunt. I haven't even researched deer in
Oh,
Colorado, but
you can draw an archery hunt on your second choice and not even mess with your bonus points.
I know. Yeah, and that's I would love to have a really killer archery hunt, but there's just it doesn't look like there's really anything offered that you would need near that many points for.
That's because every place is killer.
Yeah.
It's honestly you could throw a freaking dart at the map and every place has a potential for 200 inch field deer. And believe it or not, they got some amazing whitetail hunting there too. Yeah, if it was me, I'd be putting in, and if you could still go hunt it with your bow, I'd be putting in for, a rut mule deer hunt, one of the, prime units, and
Yeah.
you might draw that, and hell, you can have a freaking amazing bow hunt there.
Totally. Yep. No, it's a great idea. And then 2 years later, you draw an early season archery tag and have
There you go.
a killer hunt there. So
Exactly. That's what
it's
I'd be
good to have
doing, man.
options.
I don't have a crap ton of points in Colorado. I was late to the game in Colorado because, well, for the longest time, it was, and I didn't rifle hunt for a long time too. I just started rifle hunting again not too long ago. The only thing I ever rifle hunted was coos deer, and here in my own state. So I always had one rifle hunt a year that I would do. But up until recently, I didn't really travel to do rifle hunting. And then, yeah, that and. For me, I was like, well, 90% of the state's over the counter for Colorado. I never really put in for, I only have like 3 or 4 points for elk. So it's like, I'm not at this point. Just, I don't even know if I should even be chasing.
Yeah.
Was it even worth it? I don't think so. Because by the time I have 20 some odd points to go, I'm going to be a crippled old man and I won't be able to. I have a hard time walking as it is.
Well, it's like everything, Utah, Colorado, a lot of them I don't even think are worth, if you're starting now, they aren't even worth putting in for. And Colorado, we started
Exactly.
15 years ago because Unit 10, Unit 1, 201, some of those, Northwest units that were just phenomenal. Took 7 or 8 points for a non-resident to draw. And so we thought, oh,
Right.
let's start building points for those. And now they're up into the 20s. It takes 20 points to draw a unit like 61, I think 17, 18 points.
Unreal.
76 is up there to 13 or 14 points. So, those were units that you could draw with 4 or 5 points when we started. And Utah was the same. I initially went for the Wasatch Archery tag, which took 3 points for a non-resident to draw when I started. And every year it just bumped up, and now I don't know, it's 12, 13 points for a non-resident to draw that archery tag, and it's nowhere near as good as it was when we started.
Yeah, see, what pisses me off about Utah more than anything is that once you draw, you got to wait 2 years before you can start putting in again.
Yeah, used to be
So
five.
that's even more ridiculous. I mean, that's just, so you
Well, it
got to
does
wait.
help the draw odds, but yeah,
I mean,
you look at.
it does, but then you don't ever get to go. You don't ever, I mean, it's like, hey, I understand if you're not being put in the pool for 2 years, that you can't draw for 2 years, but I can't even build bonus points for 2 years.
Yeah.
That to me is stupid. Like, that's stupid on their part. They should allow people to at least buy bonus points. That's just money they're taking out of their pockets, because I would
To
have
a
bought a
degree,
bonus point.
but if it takes 13 points to draw a Wasatch archery tag right now, if they allowed you to start building points the next year, you'd be up to 15 or 16 points. So it'd take you that much longer, because everybody has 5 points and they come back in the game and now they're going to draw it in 10
True.
years instead of five more. And so it's that balance. And I look at Idaho and New Mexico. I think those are the only two states that don't have points now, bonus or preference points. And every year there's the argument that comes up that they need them. But, a 2-year wait is one of the options in Idaho. They say, if we go to points, let's just put in a 2-year wait and it won't change the draw odds all that much. And it really will. And then you have the wait. And so I mean, it's just that balance of, do you manage for quality? Do you manage for opportunity? Do
Yeah.
you, if you want quality, are you willing to wait 15 years? If you want opportunity, do you want to hunt every year? And trying to balance that for all the different
That's
opinions and
true.
styles of hunting is
I know, I
tough.
can't make everybody happy, but
Yep.
they
Fortunately,
try.
every state's different, and we can,
Yeah.
there's opportunity for about anybody who wants to hunt and their style of hunting somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, cool, man. I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your knowledge with us and kind of rounding out the Idaho stuff, some of the stuff I didn't get to in my first podcast. You're always a wealth of knowledge and pleasure to have on.
Awesome. I
So.
appreciate it. Thanks for the invite, and good luck on your hunt in Idaho if you make it here this year, and love to hear how you do.
Yeah, for sure. I might hit you up before I head out there and pick your brain a little bit more.
Definitely.
Where should our listeners go to find out more about you and what you do?
We're just about everywhere you can go digitally anymore. So elk101.com is the website. A bunch of articles, information, videos, just anything elk hunting related there. We are in the process of creating some free mini courses for elk hunters. So based on their experience, we'll walk them through a mini course that they basically have content directed towards them, whether it's planning a hunt, whether it's becoming successful, whether it's becoming consistently successful. So that's all going to be available on the website this summer, just in free mini courses there. And then social media, YouTube, Instagram, Facebook, Elk101, or Corey Jacobson. Got accounts on all of those for personal and business, so.
Well, good deal, man. Thanks a lot. We'll talk to you soon, and hopefully, whatever tags you got left out there to possibly draw, that the tag gods smile on you. All
Awesome. Thanks, John.
right, take it easy.